This is hour number two, Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. This morning, we'll take up a topic that we certainly have discussed many times before on this program. That's globalization, economic globalization. It's a very contentious subject now. There are a lot of people who would make the argument that economic globalization has, in large part, for a lot of the world, been a disaster, that it has promoted income inequality in the developing world, and that as far as the industrialized world is concerned, it's been bad for a variety of reasons, including that it has facilitated the loss of jobs to countries in the developing world. However, it wasn't always that way. There was a time when there were a lot of people who argued that globalization could be a good thing. It could be good for all of these levels, for both the large industrialized nations and for the developing ones. And our guest this morning, economist Joseph Stiglitz, says it is possible that that kind of hope, those hopes for economic globalization might still be realized. His argument is that the problem, the kind of problems that we have seen, are not the problems with globalization per se. The problem is the way that it has been managed. And he outlined some of these arguments in a new book, and it's just recently been published. The title of his book is Making Globalization Work. It is published by W.W. Norton. And he's joining us this morning by telephone to talk about it. Let me tell you just a little bit more about him. He served as a member of the Council of Economic Advisors from 1993 until 95. This was during the Clinton administration. Then he went on to serve as the chief of the council from 95 until 1997. He then became chief economist and senior vice president of the World Bank. That was between 1997 and the year 2000. He's now university professor at Columbia University in New York and chair of Columbia's Committee on Global Thought. He has also taught at a number of other universities, including Princeton, Stanford, and Oxford. He's written a number of books. He's written some economic textbooks and also some for general readership that deal with this particular subject. And one that got a lot of attention was published back in 2001. That book, Globalization and Its Discontents, was widely translated and sold. And then this new one that takes some of those arguments and advances them a little bit further. He's been good enough here to come and spend some time with us by phone to talk, and we're pleased that he could do that. Also, of course, questions are welcome. We just ask, please, people can help us keep the program moving, make lots of room for other callers, and they can help us by being brief in their comments. The number here, if you'd like to call, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. And also toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are certainly welcome. Professor Stiglitz, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
Nice to be here.
We certainly appreciate it. Maybe just to start again with the basic point and that I really made here is that if you look back, there would have been a certain point when people were very optimistic about the potential for economic globalization. They thought that it would be a good thing. And now, of course, there are a lot of people, there are people here who will argue both sides. There are people who will say, well, it hasn't been completely bad, but certainly there are a lot of people who would make the argument that indeed it has not been good, particularly for the developing world. And your argument is that, well, the problem is not necessarily globalization. The problem is how it has been carried out. And you make some suggestions for how we might do things somewhat differently in the book. Can you maybe defend a little bit that position that says, you know, globalization itself isn't the problem?
Well, the idea among economists is very strong that since Adam Smith, the idea of expanding markets gives new opportunities, allows people to take advantage of their comparative advantage, to specialize on what they're relatively good at, risk and to be diversified. The basic economic idea that widening the scale of the market should increase the overall efficiency of the economy and therefore well-being is a fairly compelling argument. And that was the idea behind globalization originally. What too many economists forgot, and many of the politicians who advocated globalization, is that markets often don't work well, and that this process of globalization therefore has to be managed very carefully, and that even when it works well, there are going to be winners and losers. And while The general theory said that the winners could compensate the losers. That is, in total, everybody could be better off. In fact, in practice, the winners seldom do compensate the losers. And therefore, we can wind up with a situation where actually there are a few very, very well-off winners at the top, but most people are actually worse off. And that's a lot of what that's at the core, I think, with a lot of the dissatisfaction with globalization today.
So just to go back and underscore that point, you would say that in economic transactions, there are always going to be winners and losers. And there's really, while maybe you can do something to mitigate the degree of loss for the losers, there's nothing that you can do to make it so that no one ever loses.
That's almost always the case. And in the area of globalization, this was one of the predictable consequences that the advocates of globalization never advertised, for very good reason. But the way to see that very vividly is to imagine a world in which markets work very well, far better than I think they do, and which we had full integration of the countries of the world, full globalization, if you might say. Well, that would mean that unskilled workers in the United States, Europe, China, and India would get all the same wage. And that would mean, of course, that the unskilled wages in the United States and the EU would be much lower than they are today. Those are among the losers in this globalization. So this is the predicted outcome. This is not just as a result of mismanagement. This is what economic theory predicts will be the result of globalization.
Is it the case that the larger industrialized nations, the reason that perhaps they're doing better and the smaller developing nations are doing worse, is it that the larger industrialized nations have some sort of inherent advantage, or do you think that it is that they're in a position to, in a sense, make the rules or to stack the deck, and what they have done actually is to, it's not just that they have inherent advantages, they've taken advantage of the fact that they can make their own, they can build their own advantages.
That is, exactly. Well, they have more power, yeah, in some sense, yeah, writing the rules of the game. Actually, it's both. One of the things I point out is that, for instance, the last major trade agreement, was called the Uruguay Round, that was signed in 1994, was so unbalanced, so unfair, that the poorest countries of the world not just got a small share of the gains. Everybody expected that. That's what you expect from power politics. But they were actually made worse off. So they were net losers. The poorest 40, 60 countries were actually net losers. On the other hand, there's also something about the nature, especially modern globalization. There's a very influential book going around, Tom Friedman, called The World is Flat. And the fact is, the world isn't flat. What he describes is some very important forces changing the global landscape. But one of the things that is emphasized is how new technologies have enabled countries like China and India to compete more effectively with the United States and Europe. But what also needs to be emphasized is that participating in this new global economy requires knowledge, technology, resources, and the poorest countries don't have those. So while there may be a narrowing of the gap between some parts, between China, India, and the United States and the EU, there's a widening gap between the poorest countries and the richest. And given that, of course, it is particularly unfortunate that we would widen that gap even further by these unfair trade rules.
Well, here I think that, you know, for people who are wanting to argue either side, and maybe who want to argue for or against globalization, they're going to take some of the places that you cited as their case studies. And for example, there are some people who might say globalization can work and has worked, and look at the success of China and India, for example. Then there are people who take the other side and say, well, wait a minute, let's look at Latin America. It hasn't worked for them. What exactly is the difference between, and this is something that you write about in the book, what exactly is the difference between what has happened in China and why that has happened, and what has happened in Latin America?
Yeah, that's a good question. And the core, to try to say it very briefly, is that China and India really have taken hold of globalization and managed it on their own terms. So, for instance, one of the doctrines that was being pushed by the IMF was what we call capital market liberalization. The country should open up their markets to speculative capital flows, money that can come in and out overnight, destabilizing the country. India and China said, no, we can't build factories on money that can come in and out overnight, but it can cause a lot of devastation. So they did not allow this full capital market liberalization. And interestingly, they were the two major emerging markets that were spared the global financial crisis that have not had a major crisis, a financial crisis in recent decades. On the other hand, Latin America was the best student of these Washington consensus policies, the kind of policies that came out of the IMF, the U.S. Treasury, World Bank, and they've had very limited growth. In fact, since they started following those lessons in the 90s, early 90s, their growth in that decade has been half of what it was in the 50s, 60s, and 70s before the modern era of globalization and before we thought, these international institutions said, we know what good economic policy means. So the core of it is that the successful countries have managed globalization on their own terms, focused on not the view of unfettered markets, but focused on how to make markets work, providing strong safety nets for their citizens, invested strongly in education and technology, a large role for the government in steering globalization and to make it work for their citizens.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Joseph Stiglitz. He served as chief economist at the World Bank until January of 2000. Before that, he was chairman of President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors. He is now professor of finance and economics at Columbia University. He has done a lot of writing and speaking on the subject, economic globalization. His new book is Making Globalization Work. It's published by W.W. Norton. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I know that you have been a pretty outspoken critic of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, even at the time, I think, when you were at the World Bank, you were, which caused, I think, some difficulties there with people in Washington. To what extent do you think that the problems, particularly the problems of debt that some developing countries are having, have to do with the fiscal policies that were really imposed on them and came from these big international organizations like the World Bank or the IMF?
Well, it clearly is a result of a lot of the policies, not just the fiscal policies. I wouldn't emphasize that as much as I would some of the other policies, the premature capital market liberalization that let capital come in, case of countries, many Latin American countries, financed the consumption boom as these countries got more in debt, was not sustainable, and that which is not sustainable won't be sustained, and they had a crisis. Other policies that they pursued was they encouraged rapid privatization on terms that were disadvantageous to the country. So again, the country wound up poorer, and in some cases, the privatized industries were well managed, but in many of the other cases, when it was done very rapidly, it was not well managed, and rather than assets being wealth being created, assets were stripped, and the country was left poorer and poorer. So I think that the policies that were foisted on these countries were in no small measure responsible for the difficulties. And it's not just one country. Remember, if it were just one country, you could blame the country, but it was country after country where the same policies were imposed, and they didn't work. And that is actually part of the problem. Too often, they imposed what we call one-size-fits-all policy. They had an ideology, a formula that they took around from country to country, and sometimes it was appropriate, but often it was not. And when it was not, there was a failure. Hmm.
Just as perhaps an illustration of some of the things we're talking about, I'm interested in getting your thoughts on the collapse of World Trade Talks earlier this summer, the Doha round came apart. This was one that was supposed to be focused on trying to provide for the development of developing countries, and I think concentrating particularly on issues of agriculture. And it reached an impasse, and I think that, again, it was one of those situations where, depending on who you ask whose fault it was, you'd get a different answer. I think that in the developing countries, they thought that essentially it was our fault. It was the fault of the United States. And the U.S. government and its trade negotiators would say, no, it was not about us. You know, everybody wants, it seems that everybody wants to protect their markets but want free access to other markets. And so we got to a point where the people who are running the talks just said, we've got nowhere to go. And I think the expectation is that they probably will start up again sometime, but I'm not sure, you know, when. If I ask the question, who really was really responsible here for the impasse, how would you answer?
I say number one, the U.S., number two, the EU. And let me explain why agriculture is so important. About 70% of the people in the developing world depend directly or indirectly on agriculture. So when we restrict our markets or we subsidize our goods, it really hurts them. Now, a lot of people think about trade in terms of tariffs and don't realize why subsidies are so important. The effect of subsidies is that they drive down the prices. America would not be growing cotton, or would not certainly be a major export of cotton, were it not for the fact that we give very large cotton subsidies. But with those cotton subsidies, we are a major exporter. As we export more, the prices of cotton go down. Now, what is so ironic about this is the United States has been saying around the world, we believe in free markets. And yet, we give between $3 to $4 billion a year to a very small number of very rich cotton farmers. It's about 25,000 cotton farmers altogether, but most of the money goes to about 15% of those. The damage that we do, it's not intentional, but the damage we do in the developing countries is enormous. In sub-Saharan Africa alone, there are 10 million cotton farmers barely living on subsistence, and we force their income lower and lower as we subsidize our cotton producers more and more. And so what it has done is it has exposed the hypocrisy of the so-called free trade regime. And what is particularly galling to many of the third world countries was that in November of 2001, at the beginning of the development round, there was a promise to reduce agricultural subsidies. And yet, what the United States did was to double its agricultural subsidies. Now it says it's going to cut them, but actually leave them higher than they were before it doubled them. It's sort of like one of those sales where, you know, you go into a store and it says on sale, but you ask, well, did you raise your price about 2 days before you put it on sale? And so there is a huge amount of enmity that results that is a result. Europe has a little bit better role. What they said is, we need a new framework. We want to, for the poorest countries, we can't expect them to reciprocate fully. They're not on a level playing field. They're much poorer. So they opened up their markets unilaterally to the poorest countries of the world. They asked the United States to join them in this initiative of, we can afford opening up our markets. It's going to hurt us. It's actually going to help us. We'll get lower prices for our goods. Our consumers are going to be better off. Our producers can absorb the inflow of a small amount. We should do this. Europe did it. The United States did something that was unfortunately totally dishonest. What they said is, we'll open up our markets for 97% of the goods. But it's an initiative that has come to be called the EBP, Everything But What You Produce. Yes, Bangladesh can export jet engines, jet airplanes, all the things that are beyond their technological capability. But when it comes to the things that they can and do produce, apparel, textiles, those are the things that we won't allow them to export to the United States. And that kind of policy of not only is it not free trade, not fair trade, but it's utter hypocrisy really engenders ill will around the world.
Well, and as you say, and you're not the only one to make the criticism, there are people around the world who give a lot of lip service to the ideas of free trade and fair trade when they say what we want is access to your markets, but we're going to protect our own producers. Would it, to the extent that it's possible, I mean, not even, I suppose, theoretically, would be possible if we really could say, okay, we're really going to have free trade, which means that's, we're going to open up all markets to everybody. We're going to take down all the trade barriers. Is that, if you could do such a thing, is that something that you would advocate? I mean, if you could wave your wand and make it happen, would you do it?
Well, 2 points. I think for the United States, for rich countries like the United States, the answer is I would go in that direction, but I wouldn't do it overnight because it takes people time to adjust. There will be losers, and we have to help those losers. People have to move from jobs that are being protected and into other jobs, and we have to create new jobs as the old jobs get lost. This doesn't happen overnight, and if you do it too quickly, there are going to be a lot more losers than winners. So it is a direction in which I would have the United States move, but I would be very careful. In the case of developing countries, the issues are more complicated because they have to learn how to enter the global market. There's an argument that's called infant industry or infant economy argument that when you are very backward, you're at a very big disadvantage. You don't know how to produce any of the industrial goods where the higher incomes are focused. And that takes a while, and in that while, protection may make sense. For instance, Korea did this. Korea now is has been enormously successful. Its GDP has increased per capita eightfold in the last 30 years. But they did it by actually going from producing rice to producing semiconductors, automobiles. At the beginning, many, many outside advisors, IMF, World Bank, said, you ought to specialize in your comparative advantage, what you do well. And they said, look, we could become the most efficient rice farmers, and our people will still be poor. We need to go up the next stage. And so they invested a lot in education and technology, and it protected those industries. And they now can survive without the protection. And so that's what a lot of developing countries need, that interim, that temporary protection to help them compete with those who've had the advantage of 100 years of development. Hmm.
We have as our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Joseph Stieglitz. He served as a member of the Council of Economic Advisors during the Clinton administration. That was between 93 and 95. And then for 2 years, he was the chairman of the council. He then became chief economist and senior vice president of the World Bank. He is now university professor at Columbia University in New York and is chair of Columbia's Committee on Global Thought. He received the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2001. He's also taught at Princeton, at Stanford, and at Oxford. He's authored a number of books. He's written some textbooks and also books for a more general reader dealing with the subject of globalization. One that came out in 2001 titled Globalization and Its Discontents. It has sold very well around the world. He has a new one that deals with some of the same subjects, and that book is Making Globalization Work. It is published by Norton, W.W. Norton, as his number of his other books are published by Norton. And he's joining us this morning by phone. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana listeners. Also, we do have that toll-free line, 800-222-9455. And someone here to talk with in Urbana, line one.
Hello? Oh, hi. It's a distinct honor to talk to you. I was curious about in Friedman's book, when it's the Earth is flat, I'm sort of concerned about the environment and all this deal because, to me, it's more like the environment is being flattened, where in which you spread all of this consumption machine from the West out to the third world where they can't, you know, environmentally or economically handle it. And then, as you said earlier, how they're subjected to the, like, the farming community in these third world countries or lesser developed or whatever the latest name is, are basically ruined by these subsidies from the West. And I'm just concerned about the environment always seems to be, and when I've listened to economists on this show for many years, and I asked one of the local economists who comes on this program about if there was any environmental economics using that term, and he said there was some term called desilization, and it sounded to me more like a medical term than an economic term, and I did sort of find out about it and looked it up. But where's the environment in all this deal, where in which we are consuming so much of the resources of the world? Where are the variables?
I agree with you very strongly about the importance of the environment, and I actually have one whole chapter in my new book, Making Globalization Work, devoted to that, and I talk about it in several of the other chapters. And let me explain why. It's an example of one of the many values that are not adequately reflected in market economics. There are other things like the value of life. We've reduced access to life-saving medicines in the way our trade agreements have made generic medicines less accessible. Security has been another thing that's fallen by the wayside. So there are many things, many important values, culture, that market economics doesn't handle well, and the way globalization has been managed has given short shrift to these other values. But environment is a particularly important one in my own mind, because unless we manage the environment well, the most, you know, the object of economic growth is raising living standards. And if global warming means that we our whole economy suffers enormously, economic globalization, making economic globalization work, won't help. So I have a chapter where I talk about the problems of global warming, also as emblematic of the failures of global governance. Here we have a problem that everybody understands, or almost everybody understands. If we don't get reduce our CO2 emissions, the Earth is going to warm. Already the polar ice cap is melting. Sea levels rise. Islands, I had a meeting just a couple weeks ago with heads of a number of the Pacific Island states. They're going to be underwater within 50, 75 years. They won't exist even. A third of Bangladesh, it will be underwater. This very poor country, people are going to be crowded even closer together. It highlights a couple points. First, that some of these environmental problems have the greatest impact on those who are already suffering the most, the poorest. And they are both more vulnerable and less able to cope. And we see that there was a recent article just a couple of days ago from the Ivory Coast of how global pollution, sludge from a ship, was taken from the Netherlands that said, no, this is too toxic for us to handle, for us to clean without charging you $300,000. And this multi-billion-dollar company said, we don't want to pay $300,000. Took this sludge down to Ivory Coast, dumped it there, and it's caused a major health problem down in Ivory Coast. Now, that illustrates an example of globalization that it's like the armed bandits used to go across the state boundaries, you know, in our cowboy movies that we used to watch, and find a safe haven. Now, under the way globalization is working today, this company that caused this enormous damage in Ivory Coast may not be able to be sued because it can go back home. It has no assets in Ivory Coast. What can Ivory Coast do to get at them? We don't have a global liability regime that makes those who do this kind of damage liable and make them pay for the cost that they impose. The final point I want to make, it picks up on another theme that you raised. If everybody in the world consumed used resources at the level that they're consumed in the United States,
the world can't go on. Mm-hmm. We just can't do it. So, interestingly, as China's growing, they are increasingly becoming aware that even they can't environmentally, unless they do something about the environment, their growth is going to be hampered. And that's why the Chinese government has moved the issue of the environment towards the top of their economic agenda. It's unfortunate that the advanced industrial countries haven't done the same. At least the United States hasn't done it. And hasn't realized that the kinds of policies that we pursue, if everybody else pursues those, the world is really facing a disaster.
One other question I wanted to ask you. We talk about globalization, and I think, in my opinion, it sort of depends on inexpensive energy and shipping costs. Now, as energy rises because of consumption of, you know, the in-ground oil and stuff like that, do you think that globalization will inevitably slow down because of the prohibitive costs of shipping these products, like, you know, just junk from China or whatever, you know, things we buy, things that go to the store.
Sure.
Do you think that's an important issue, or do you think that can be addressed through markets, or do you think it has to be addressed through politics?
Well, first of all, let me say there are many dimensions to globalization, like mm-hmm. financial market globalization that led such havoc in global financial markets just in 97, 98. That's not affected by increasing oil prices. Those electrons that transfer money from one country to another, that's not energy, doesn't use energy mm-hmm. in any significant degree. The movement of goods obviously uses energy, but advances in technology will undo much of the increase, the effect of the increase in oil prices. So I think it will slow it down slightly, but the other aspects of globalization, including the reduction in communication costs, are going to have a more than offsetting effect, so that I don't think that the increase in oil prices by themselves will really impose a major impediment in the process of globalization. The politics of it, the way we've mismanaged globalization, is a far more important likely barrier to the continuation of globalization as it has been. And that is a very great worry.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate talking to you.
All right, well, thanks for the call. We have some others. Next is an Urbana listener here, line number two. Hello.
Hello. Yeah, we've heard so much about globalization and free trade, but what we haven't heard is about workers' rights. And it seems we're under President Bush's influence here that the paramount goal is for the bottom line of corporate profits, as opposed to any acquiescence to workers' rights. And it seems to me we're repeating the Karl Marx precedent when he said that workers unite, we have nothing to fear, but a release of our chains, something to that. You get my message. But my question is two parts. What is the status of workers' rights in the process of globalization? And secondly, how can workers' rights be effectuated into that process?
Well, I mean, the first point that you make is that trickle-down economics doesn't work. There are some people, even in the administration, who've tried to pretend that globalization is great because profits are up and increase in profits are going to benefit everybody. The fact is that's not true. Even though corporate profits are up, GDP may be up, the average American is poorer today than he was 6 years ago. Median family income is down. Trickle-down economics has never worked, and it's not working now. On the other issue, it's more complicated. There is a great worry in the developing countries that labor standards will be used as an excuse for borrowing their goods from advanced industrial countries. These are sometimes called blue tariffs, that you will demand so high labor standards corresponding to advanced industrial countries that they will not be able to satisfy them and use that as an excuse, as a new excuse to keep their goods out of the market. I think there's a growing consensus over the following idea, that there's a set of basic labor standards called the core labor standards that have been agreed upon by the International Labor Organization, which is a tripartite, very important organization in Geneva, involving government, business, and labor. And they've thought about what are the most important, you know, basic principles like no prison labor, producing goods, but most importantly, the right to get together, to form unions, to bargain, the right to collective bargaining. And those are rights that we ought to argue for and work towards, perhaps even saying that countries that don't embrace those may not be eligible for the kinds of trade benefits that are a basis of the global trading regime.
Well, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. You mentioned way back at the beginning of the program is that you know, they're in any economic transaction, there are going to be winners and losers, and that certainly there was the idea that perhaps in economic globalization there would be winners and losers, and that the idea is that one way to mitigate the degree of loss is for the winners to, in some sense, compensate the losers, and that that hasn't happened. How do you, and given the fact that now we do indeed have some people here who have benefited through economic globalization, how do you make the argument to them that there are reasons? I mean, can you make almost a dollars and cents argument, if it's not going to be a moral argument, to them that there are reasons for them to actually to agree to benefit less? It's not, you know, not sure. Exactly that we put them in the position of being losers, but that, you know, maybe so maybe their profits are somewhat less.
Yeah. Why unmitigated pursuit of your self-interest may not be in your self-interest, to put it in a way.
Well said.
And the answer is very much so. And I think there are several reasons for this. Within our own country, the issue is, will there be a backlash against globalization? And it's not only true here, it's also true in Europe. Last spring, young workers in France went out on marching. They were told that they had to accept lower wages and less job protections because of globalization. And they said, we don't understand. You told us globalization was going to make us better off. Now you're telling us that globalization means that we have to accept lower wages and less job benefits. How do lower wages and less job benefits make us better off? Hmm. And, you know, sometimes the answer kind of came back, well, in the long run. But it's been 30 years now that wages in the United States at the bottom have been stagnant. Actually, now they're about 30% lower than they were 30 years ago. That's a working lifetime. Keynes, the great economist of the last century, put it very aptly when he said, in the long run, we're all dead. And if we don't make sure that the benefits of globalization are more widely shared, that there are more winners, fewer losers, there will be a backlash. Some people say, no, globalization is inevitable. It's like a cod liver oil. You just have to swallow it. It's good medicine for you. The fact is, for many people, it's not good medicine. It's actually been hurting them. But secondly, it's not inevitable. The degree of globalization before World War I, as measured, for instance, by the ratio of trade to GDP or the ratio of capital flows to GDP, was stronger than in the interwar period. We passed the Smoot-Hawley tariffs. We did other things that reduced the scope of globalization. And the same thing is already happening now. There are so many losers that questions are being raised. So if they want to continue to enjoy the benefits of globalization, they also have to make sure that the benefits are more widely shared. Mm. There's a second argument, and that is that the developing countries have woken up to the fact that they aren't benefiting, that they were actually, as I said before, worse off after the last round of trade negotiations. They have democracies now. That's a great achievement. But democracies say, you know, if you come back with another agreement as unfair as the last agreement, you're out of office. And that new kind of political accountability means that we will not have another agreement that is as unfair as the last one. And that's why the Doha round, the development round, broke down. It's the victory of democracy in some ways, but it's something that we have to come to terms with.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, we get affected by migration and by terrorists. Migration, major problem for America. What is the reason for it? It's the lack of economic opportunity in other countries. And as long as there are huge economic disparities, there will be huge migration pressures. And, you know, we can pass all the laws we want. There are going to be ways people find of getting around them.
Mm.
And in terms of terrorists, although while we don't know what causes terrorism, very complex, we do know this, that despair, the lack of opportunity, is a fertile feeding ground for terrorists. And unfortunately, the kinds of economic policies that give no opportunities to those in the third world are creating that kind of despair in much of the world.
We have someone else here to bring into the conversation, someone on our toll-free line there in Rankin. So let's talk with them. Line four. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. You just segued into the topic that I wanted to raise. Earlier, David had on Eldridge Cleaver's widow, and when I spoke to her about the disparities in America where poverty actually leads to crime, I would like to hear your comments on whether or not globalization, which started well before we had this global terror thing going on, didn't in fact either create or contribute to the situation that we're seeing now. And I'll hang up.
Yeah, the first point you make is a really important one, that there is a clear connection between crime and economic disparity. If you don't have economic opportunity in order to be a constructive member of our society, there's a higher likelihood that you'll take a destructive approach. And there are a lot of economic analyses which show, you know, crime is a very complex phenomena, but clearly related to economic well-being. And during the 90s, the growth in economic income, reduction of poverty, improvements of the living standards at the bottom was one of the important factors contributing to the reduction in the crime rate. I think it was probably the most important contributing to the reduction in crime rate in America. Well, that same kind of analysis, that same kind of reasoning is behind terrorists. Again, a lot of fat forces go into terrorism. But one of the things you have to ask, you know, what leads people to be willing to sacrifice their life, to risk their life? One of the things that affects it, at the margin at least, is no hope, no economic hope, no opportunity, no constructive way of engagement in society. And in countries where the unemployment rate is 10, 15, 20, 25, 30%, particularly among young males, it's a predictable outcome.
We have about 10 minutes left, actually a little bit less in this part of Focus. I just want to introduce again very quickly our guests, in case someone has just tuned in. Joseph Stiglitz served as chief economist at the World Bank until January of 2000. Before that, he was chairman of President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors. He is currently professor of finance and economics at Columbia University, won the Nobel Prize in Economics 2001. His new book is Making Globalization Work. It's published by W.W. Norton. You set out a number of ambitious, and I suppose some people would say radical, kinds of suggestions here in the book, all as part of this argument that says, as we've said from the beginning, that globalization in and of itself, not necessarily bad way it's been carried out, that's the problem. You're talking about making a number of changes. It's just still seems to me, you know, hanging in with the last thought and something that you talk about in the last chapter of the book about the fact that this, what we're talking about here, the important thing here is politics, that the way the system is depends on politics. You write that reforming globalization is a matter of politics. I'm sure that the kind of arguments that you make and the kind of changes you suggest are pretty tough sell in Washington, D.C. these days.
Well, first let me say that I what I try to explain is that globalization is going to change. The rules of the game are going to change. Something as flawed, as problematic as the way it's been managed in the past can't go on. I talk about this in each of the areas that I focus on. For instance, we were talking about agricultural subsidies earlier. The WTO has already ruled America's cotton subsidies are illegal. They will have to go eventually. The global financial system is based on what is called the dollar reserve system. Confidence in the dollar is quickly eroding. That will change. Everybody recognizes that we need another trade agreement, but we won't be able to get another agreement as unbalanced as the last one. And so if we're going to have progress, we'll have to do something that is fairer than what we did in the past. So the question in my mind is not whether there will be change, but whether we will make these changes in response to a crisis, some kind of patchwork, fixing one problem quickly, but not in a way that is thoughtful, and that will lead to the next crisis down the line, another couple years, limping along as we have to a large extent in the past, or whether we will try to engage in the process of change in a more thoughtful way, trying to think about these problems in a more rational way and then make the changes. Now, let me say, I think that a lot of the ideas I put forward will take a number of years to come about. But a lot of the changes I talk about are already in moving along, and really what all I'm doing is calling for an acceleration, recognition of how important some of these changes are. For instance, a lot of attention has been given to the debt crises, the debt problems, the number of countries in debt, not just one country, but large numbers. Why is that? Not just fiscal profligacy. The fact is that they've had to borrow in hard currencies, in dollars. They haven't been able to borrow in their own currencies. Well, in recent years, the last couple years, there are growing markets allowing countries to borrow in their own currencies, and that will improve reduce the likelihood of the kinds of debt crises that we've had in the past. So that's an example of something I call for. We're beginning to move in that direction. And what I'm trying to do is outline what I think of are some of the important changes that we can build on to help make globalization work, or at least work a lot better than it has been.
Hmm. Well, if we move away from the dollar as being this kind of international benchmark currency, at least something that countries use as a way to hold their reserves, what do you move to?
Well, countries are moving away from the dollar. The reason they used to hold the dollar was they believed it was a strong, good store of value.
Yeah.
But in recent years, the value of the dollar has been eroding very rapidly, so it's no longer a good store of value. And they figured that out. It took them a while, but they figured it out. So central banks have moved considerably out of the dollar. They've gone into a principle we call diversification. What I call for is an idea that actually Keynes talked about almost 75 years ago, which is creating an international currency, an international reserve, not one that you would use day to day, but would central banks would hold. We've actually done it in the IMF and the what are called the SDR special drawing rights, but we've only done it about three or four times, and it's worked when we've done it. But what I'm suggesting is a way that we can do this on an annual basis. And that will actually make an enormous difference to global financial stability, as well as to actually a lot of equity in the. It will help particularly the developing countries, and that's the next to last chapter of my book is actually devoted to showing how it will lead to both more stability and help development.
See, we can quick squeeze in one more. Matt Toon, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'm interested to know how you believe that the elimination of agricultural subsidies here in the United States will benefit farmers in developing countries.
Well, it's actually very simple. What happens with our agricultural subsidies is that it leads farmers to produce more than they would without subsidies. That's the when you increase the price that producers receive, which is what subsidies do, they lead to more production. Greater increases in supply mean that just the laws of supply and demand work, and that means lower prices. The most dramatic example of that is in the case of cotton that I talked about before, but the other dramatic example is in the case of corn and the impact that globalization, the North American Free Trade Agreement, had on Mexico, our neighbor to the south. The effect of the corn subsidies is to lower the price of corn by about 50%. And that means that the poor Mexican farmers, the poorest people in Mexico are corn farmers. After NAFTA, their prices fell dramatically because they no longer could protect them, and they had to face the depressed prices that are a result of American corn subsidies. And so we made the poorest people in Mexico poor. I mean, obviously, we didn't intend to make them poor, but that was the effect of the North American Free Trade Agreement.
I'm going to have to jump in here. My apologies to you, Professor Stieglitz, and the last caller, but we're going to have to stop because we've used the time. If you'd like to read more on the subject, the book is Making Globalization Work by W.W. Norton. That's the publisher, by our guest, Joseph Stieglitz. He was chief economist at the World Bank until January 2000. Before that, chairman of President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors. He's now professor of finance and economics at Columbia University. Professor Stieglitz, thanks very much.
Well, thank you.